Good morning, New Orleans. We've got a great show today. It's No Filter Friday. I'm going to throw out a couple of issues that are breaking news over the last 24 hours, and we'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about the Saints game this weekend. Big game. Really big game against the Eagles. They always play us tough. And then we're on a short week. And Thursday night, we play again. And there's NBC, I think, has got some special things that they're going to be doing in order to promote the city. We should be very excited about that. Trombone Shorty, as well as Emeril Lagasse, are included in their special plans. We tried to get them on the show this morning. They're both traveling, and they weren't able to pull it off, and they apologize for saying they're always very receptive to coming on and talking about this place that we call home, that we're so excited about being here. And LSU's got a game as well. They play Rice at home. And important game for the bowl picture. Any number of possibilities for them. The best way to get to the best bowl right now for them is just to win out the last two games, Texas A&M and Rice. And we'll see how that plays out this morning. We're also going to be giving away a set of Saints tickets. We want to put you in that number. When the Saints play the Steelers on Sunday, December 23rd, we have one pair of tickets to give away today. Here's all you have to do. Just listen to win. When you hear Bobby Hebert say, "Who dat?" I'll give you the number to call in. If you're the eighth caller, you'll be who datting with the rest of the Who Dat Nation as the Saints play the Steelers in the Dome. Remember, listen to win, and the contest line will be closed until I announce the number. All right. You know, one of the things, and I'll throw this out, that kind of surprised me in many respects from many angles was liberal activist and news correspondent Van Jones, who has worked with the Trump White House on a historically divisive issue, criminal justice reform. And, you know, how dare he, says the left. A compromise has been reached after 2 years of negotiation amongst Republicans, Democrats, law enforcement, prosecutors, and a multitude of social activists. Van Jones stepped out and said that Trump is on his way to becoming the uniter in chief, and after the president announced his support for the bill. Mr. Jones has put his heart and soul into this issue for quite some time, and as such, I think he was just enjoying the moment and certainly expressing hope for more bipartisan successes. How dare he, the Hollywood left, and others quickly slapped him down and basically said, "Hey, dude, chill out." Bazaar Dabu, a Hollywood actor and social activist, said, "I love it, Van Jones 68, but I disagree with this sentiment calling 45 the uniter-in-chief. If I get punched in the face 25 times by someone and then they stop for a few minutes and get me an ice pack, that doesn't make them a peaceful healer all of a sudden. He's not a uniter at all." And then Rolling Stone writer Jameel Smith tweeted, "I cannot fully trust any bill that Trump would endorse, criminal justice reform, or otherwise." Well, so much for leaving our respective corners and attempting to find common ground, huh, in order to reach a compromise. I mean, that's all everybody's talking about, but obviously that can't happen. Van Jones went on to say, I say the 99 times I don't agree with the president, I'm going to give him hell. But on this one, I got to give him a salute and an applause. We've got to come together to help the people at the bottom. I don't know about you folks, but I think the left just should chill out. Take a breath, embrace the credible leadership example exhibited by Van Jones and all the others who worked on this legislation. This has been something that has been very difficult. Mr. Jones went on to say Obama couldn't accomplish it. He tried. It didn't work. And he said, so you got to give credit where credit's due. What's so wrong with doing that? And look, I don't always agree with any number of observations made by Van Jones. But I do agree with several that he's made over the past 2 years through the election period and in the aftermath of same. But the facts are, if he's willing to put skin in the game and try and change people's minds and find common ground and reach a compromise, Is that not what we're all asking for? And here's a guy who's not even really political. He's a news correspondent. And all of a sudden, they work something out. They're excited about it, bipartisan, working with the administration over a two-year period of time. They craft it. And the left then starts attacking the left because they don't want any conversation about a success. So it doesn't do much for my confidence level that we're going to end up doing anything in a bipartisan standpoint in the future. If even when we reach the accomplishment that if you say one good thing about the other side, all hell breaks loose, and they're not willing to give even one congratulatory slap on the back or anything short of that in recognition of a willingness to come to the middle and resolve an issue. I don't know. You tell me 260-1870 or text me at 870-870. I thought that's what everybody wanted. It doesn't seem that that's the case. Love to hear what you have to say on that issue. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. On the text line, it says, the left is a big tent with many opinions. Exactly who is they? That's who the they is who I want to hear from. I mean, the fact of the matter is that most of the folks that posted on any of these articles were anti the position that Van Jones took. In fact, very few were pro, if any at all, in a number of the publications that I looked at. In fact, when he did his CNN interview with Don Lemon, it didn't take much to see the disgust on Don Lemon's face with the words that Van Jones was talking about. And during that interview with Don Lemon, he went on to say some other things, and I mean, it was blatantly obvious that he was not happy with that. Van Jones went on to say that Trump is accomplishing things former President Barack Obama could not, and said the president deserved a salute for his efforts. So I say the 99 times I don't agree with the president, I'm going to give him hell. It's called the First Step Act on the criminal justice reform. You know, and then there's others on the text that are saying, it sounds like you're a divider. I'm not a divider. I'm just pointing out that in order for us to create momentum in a culture of being able to compromise, we cannot fear saying a couple of that a boys to the other side or that a girl. It cannot be that way. We have to be able to recognize when there are successes. Right away, one of the first questions out of Don Lemon's mouth in the interview, well, there are those that said that this has not gone far enough. No kidding, Don. That's what compromise is all about. There are those on the right that said it went too far. There are those on the left that said it didn't go far enough. So what they did is they found compromise, common ground, in the middle as a first step in order to move this issue forward. So right away, because we're talking about something that some people don't want to hear, I'm a divider. I'm trying to divide people on the issue. No, to the contrary. I'm giving a congratulatory that a boy to Van Jones, who I don't agree with most of the times, but he is real on this issue. He's sincere about it. He's put a lot of work in it. He's contributed a lot of time and effort towards this negotiation process between the Republicans and the Democrats and the administration on criminal justice reform. Do I agree with everything in criminal justice reform? No, I don't. But I realize that we are not going to jail our way out of this problem. It doesn't mean that it comes at the sacrifice of good, clean, aggressive law enforcement with empathy, sympathy, and a high level of intellect. That's not what it means. There is some re-engineering and fine-tuning. If we're careful about how we do it, where we're able to reach and reap some benefits from what we are able to deploy strategically in this fight against crime. All the while understanding that law enforcement's obligation and responsibility is to seek out the bad guy and arrest him. Plain and simple. Now, how is that dividing at all? We'd love to hear from you, 260-1870, or text us at 870-870. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking about the Acosta ruling as well with the administration. We're trying to get an expert on, and we'll see if we're able to do that. And also, kind of breaking news last evening, court rules that Hillary Clinton must answer more questions about her emails. This pretty much did not go, wasn't really reported that much around last evening on a lot of the main news stations. But two questions that Clinton will have to answer within 30 days, according to Judge Sullivan's ruling. This was a case that was actually brought by the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit by a watchdog group that wants some more answers from Hillary Clinton. And the two questions that the judge ruled on is that describe the creation of the ClintonEmail.com system, including who decided to create the system, the date it was decided to create the system, why it was created, who set it up, and when it became operational. So that's the first question. The second question, during your October 22nd, 2015 appearance before the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee on Benghazi, you testified that 90 to 95% of your emails were in the State Department system. And if they wanted to see them, they would certainly have been able to do so. Identify the basis for this statement, including all the facts on which you relied on in support of that statement. How and when you became aware of these facts, and if you were made aware of these facts by or through another person, identify the person who made you aware of these facts. Obviously, that's a trap question because she didn't have 90 to 95% of her emails in the State Department system. They were on her own system, and they're trying to get to the bottom of that. I'm sure that this ruling is going to be appealed, and so I wouldn't be looking for these answers within the next 30 days. Interestingly enough, though, during the course of this litigation, the Justice Department as well as the State Department were still defending Hillary Clinton. And they were still trying to shield these emails and the answers to these questions from being revealed. And it was also revealed during the course of this litigation that under oath in October of 2016, near the end of the 2016 presidential campaign, Clinton answered, does not recall, to 20 out of the 25 written questions that were presented to her in her interview. And so that was one of the reasons why these folks tried to go about getting more information about what was going on at that time, because she basically refused to answer the questions just by saying she does not recall and any of the information as it relates to that. There are many that are saying that this piece of litigation could be a disaster for her 2020 ambitions to run for president. And as you know, there's been a lot more discussion about her doing that and making her way around and trying to run for president of the United States, and that's been bantered around as well. Also want to talk about and want to get your reaction to Senator Kamala Harris's testimony before the committee. She had the Homeland Security, the interim Homeland Security person before the committee through their nominating process. And when we come back out of the break, We'll talk about that as well. And we're also in last hour, we're going to be talking about, the Saints as well as LSU. On the text line, well, I was happy he agreed to sign it. I did not see this attitude on the shows I watched this morning today. You like Van Jones because Trump agreed to sign the bill. You have opposed these changes on the air yourself before. If Trump had refused to sign it, I imagine you would have agreed. No, I've not opposed all of these changes before. I think that there needs to be, a connection to what's actually being changed. This overarching notion or idea that we over-incarcerate is the thing that I have difficulty squaring up. Because incarceration is an outcome. We have too many offenders. And when you look at the breakdown of crimes in any jurisdiction across this country, over 80% of the crimes are property crimes. So those are crimes that, they're not crimes of violence. And the facts are that somebody reports to law enforcement that they're a victim of a crime and their camera picked up this or they're that or whatever, and we go about arresting those people. And it's not proactive work, it's reactive work. So the argument is always framed in the manner in which we're going out and selecting who that perpetrator is. And that is, in fact, not the case. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We're back. Want to hear from you. 260-1870 or text us at 870-870. Talking about activist Van Jones, who has worked with the Trump White House on a historically divisive issue, criminal justice reform. And he ended up saying some good things about the president because the president agreed to sign this as a compromise bipartisan effort in order to move this forward through the Congress. Parts of this bill had actually already had been previously passed, and they were trying to expand upon that a little, and I think that they were successful in doing so. And as he said, it was a first step. And, it wasn't something that was the end all, but he was felt good about the process and felt good about the president's approving to support this in moving forward. And my question to you is that when we ask, and if we really desire for bipartisanship, why is it that it's so hard to congratulate or thank the other side for engaging in that process when we're able to successfully achieve something in working together? And do we still have to retreat to our corners? We can just go out and there for just a little bit of time and then retreat to our corners. And there are many folks on the left that are attacking him for saying it. He didn't say he is the uniter in chief. I've got some text about that. He said is on his way to being uniter in chief. I think, is that an aggressive statement? Yeah, I'm not so sure that's where this is headed. But on this particular issue, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had taken this on as well and has been kind of the face of this issue for the administration moving forward and has been able to convince a number of people in the administration and around the administration that this is a necessary move at this point in time because there are some outcomes that just don't make sense. I mean, I've said that all along. And it would seem to me that I think discretion in the judiciary sometimes leads to crazy outcomes. And for those that are always attacking it, I said, well, then let's go to an if-then system. If X, then Y. Move all subjectivity out of it. And then we'll go from there. Let's go to line one. Talk to Derek. What say you, Derek?
Hey, New. Yep. Hey, look, everybody's always said about, talk about prison reform and all that. And, I always thought of it like this, on the money trail. People talk about, keeping prisoners as a form of making money. How does that start? How does that start? When you arrest somebody and you put them in jail and you charge in the state to keep them in prison, and then the state charges the federal, and there's all kind of money trail. How does that work?
Well, first, let me just say, most people don't know what they're talking about. And it all depends on how the jail is funded. So let me just tell you about Jefferson Parish, for example. We have a jail that houses, I think, 1,100 inmates and 100 in booking, so a total of 1,200. 95, 96, 97% of those are pretrial detainees waiting to go to trial. We get $3.50 a day for feeding and keeping from the parish of Jefferson, and all the other costs to house those inmates are borne by the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office revenue. It costs the sheriff's office somewhere north of $40 a day to keep those inmates. So there is no money to be made on an inmate. And as soon as they're sentenced, within 2 weeks of being sentenced, once we receive the commitment papers to go into the Department of Corrections, the state system, to serve the state time, we ship them out.
Okay,
and the only time that we get money from the state, which is $21 a day, is in that 2 week period from commitment to the date that we ship them out, and we lose money then even at $21 a day. So most people misunderstand. It's a smokescreen that's put up by the detractors that want to limit incarceration as a punishment for being an offender. I got to get to a break. If you want to hold on, Derek, we'll come back to this issue when we return. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and we'll go back to Derek. I think he had another question. Go ahead, Derek.
Yeah, so as far as when you send them out to the state corrections and all, why is it – is there any kind of things in there that can – reform these people instead of sending them in jail? Let me take an example.
Yeah, I mean, they have rehabilitative programs. Do they have enough? No.
No.
And that's where a lot of the failures are, is that there are not enough rehabilitative programs offered so that when they try to, or when they are released and they're going to come back into our communities, so to put them in the best position to be able to assimilate back into our communities, that's where we get a big return on our dollar. In fact, I funded a program where I helped pay for the cost of transportations for children of incarcerated males so that they could visit their father, they could maintain a relationship with their father, and he wouldn't be some, you know, image in the night. So it'd be upfront and real for them, and they could maintain that relationship. And in that same program, when these folks came out or rolled out of DOC, we hooked them up with folks to try and have them have some early on successes as they assimilated back in the community, to have the high of their family, to have the high of their Lord, whoever that may be, to reconnect them with their church and to try to get them a job so that they don't have the immediate high of the drug, which most of them had that addictive disorder going in.
And look, another thing that kind of, there's some crimes out there, like cold-blooded murder and all of that. That's something that I don't think there's anything that can possibly make me kill somebody in cold-blooded murder. But let's say a smaller crime, a felony or something, they go and they do their 2 or 3 years. Why does that felony thing hang over their head? And then when they apply for jobs, the employers see this felony and they really don't want to deal with them. So why does that felony have to hang over their head once they did their time? I think that causes a lot of the problems too.
And it does. But I mean, the facts are is that you want to know as many things as you can about your employee base. And given the choice between somebody who's abided by the rules and lived a moral lifestyle and one who hasn't, if you're the employer, who are you going to choose?
Yeah,
the facts are that is a reality of the outcome. Unfortunately, you know, we're trying to turn the tide a little bit as it relates to that perspective, to understand that, you know, in many respects, model prisoners have paid their debt to society, and then they, when they roll out, many of which I hired when I was sheriff. I couldn't hire them to be on the enforcement side, but I hired them to work in the motor pool and in other non-enforcement positions around the sheriff's office.
Yeah.
Because they had a desire to work, and they had a trade, and they were good at their trade. And when they couldn't get a job somewhere else, we hired. Now, let me just be totally transparent. Was it a bunch? No, because I didn't have that many opportunities to hire, meaning opportunities from a job perspective, not that they didn't have a bunch of applicants. I would have loved to have hired more, quite frankly, because I think it would have made a significant difference in their life, and it was a safe place to work in the sheriff's office. And they weren't going to be exposed to a lot of the temptations that they were exposed to before they went in to jail. Probably most of the folks out there are surprised to hear me say that. But the reality is there's plenty of room for compromise. In fact, in this bill alone that we're talking about, the First Step Act, 2,700 faith and evangelical leaders, hundreds of conservative organizations and leaders supported the legislation, as well as a number of liberal organizations came together in order to pass this legislation. And as I pointed out earlier, those on the left that want to criticize Van Jones will never have successes, because why would they go out and risk, you know, being critical of the body in which they actually represent? Doesn't make sense to me.
Doesn't make sense to me either. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
All righty, Derek, thank you so much. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. On the text line, we got a little off the topic there, but that's okay. On the text line, how about speaking to the for-profit prisons we have through the state? Your opinion on their use and the current contracts, please. I was never a big proponent of for-profit prisons, to be quite frank with you. There were a number of sheriffs that engaged in it, and when I say a number, it was not even close to half the sheriffs in the state of Louisiana. If you believe some of the reports, you would believe that every sheriff was involved in that. And all the while that Sheriff Lee was the sheriff and while I was sheriff, we did not house state inmates, nor did we house federal inmates, nor did we house any other inmates from other states like some folks did, because they were able to get a revenue source. Did they make a profit? Not in most cases. What it allowed them to do, it was basically contribution margin business. It covered their fixed operating cost. So they were able to create jobs, house inmates. It's good for the small local economies to do that. And this started about in the 90s, where there was some federal court rulings that they were going to have to improve their facilities or expand their facilities at the state level because of jail overcrowding. There was no money to do so. So they came up with this idea that had been used in other areas of the country to engage in contracts with for-profit prisons that were run by the private sector. And they went down that path. The model ultimately is not a bad model if it was a full-service model. We were previously talking about rehabilitative measures being offered so that when they roll out in a better position to assimilate into society and try to reduce recidivism. That's the ultimate goal. But if you're not offering the rehabilitative programs while in there, you're just going to face the same problem that you had the first time they went in. And you have to think outside of the box and outside of yourself a little bit. And that's not being soft on crime. It's being smart on crime. And unfortunately, what did not happen in the for-profit arena is that they did not or were not able to charge enough money in order to provide the rehabilitative services necessary. Let's go to line one, talk to Daniel. What say you, Daniel?
Hello, how you doing, Noah?
Doing great.
I'm a first-time caller to your show. I used to listen to Garland, but first time, man, and I'm glad I'm here for such a topic.
Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate the call.
Okay, well, what I say is, based off of, personal experience, one of the biggest challenges for someone who are trying to make a return successfully, and help curb the recidivism rate is that 9 times out of 10, guys who go to jail, they were bad guys, or, you know, most of the time they were bad. They probably ran drugs, disturbed, they had little or no family or family to trust, you know, and they have nothing to go home to. And there were places such as work release facilities, you know, scattered throughout the state, but just a handful of them. And where the problem comes in is that you have a disproportionate amount of convicted felons who do their time, go home without any type of nest egg or anything to return to. And then, you know, as they say, when your ribs are touching, your teeth are showing. And now, you know, you go to the thing that you know, which ain't the right thing to do.
Right.
However, there's the reentrance program, which is good, you know, for first offenders. They go through boot camp.
Right.
And some of these guys, they might go straight home, but most of them take up all of the bed spaces around the state for the pre-release or work release.
Right.
So the guys who really need it don't get a chance to go. So I would say if there's money or funding aside somewhere, let's get more.
Daniel, I don't mean to cut you off, but I got to get to a break. But I couldn't agree with you more. I think you're spot on, and I think your recommendation is absolutely correct. We'll be right back.